Thank you. time I've been to Rochester in about 20 years. And all of you are on either side here tonight. This is always, this is a very frequent location for a stage, and it's always just a little hard to know what to do with it. I'm basically just talking, except for the fact that I am aware of not having been here for a very long time. I'm here, I'm speaking because I'm compelled to at this moment. If I don't say something, there's a tension that begins to grow and it becomes hostility within a very short period of time. And that, you know, that's, and it's blood curdling. There's no way to recover from it. And once you've been sort of deemed a jerk. And of course, then I start thinking, you're all a bunch of jerks. So, even though I never have literally anything to say at this point, except to announce that I'm compelled to speak, I know that no matter what comes out of my mouth, I'm being professional, because the alternative is much worse. At least, the problem with that is that I know that, but you don't. You think, you know, why is this guy babbling on like this? Or as somebody said to me about a week ago, we came to hear you play guitar, and they told me this after the set was over with. This is a song I have never been able to get out of my head. Since I first heard it as a bubblegum hit by a group called something or that, I forget. It was a hit again in a sort of country version or country pop version or country fied or whatever the industry mavens decided to call it. Look how I'm playing and talking at the same time. Wow. Say is that I can't believe how happy this guy is in this song, and I have never been this happy. I'd like to introduce the blender. Percussion from Oscar. Ring, ring, telephone ring, somebody says, baby, what you doing? I've been wondering where you've been, now and then I think about you and me. No use fighting about things we can't recall, 'cause it don't matter now at all. Just come on. Maybe we'll laugh and sing, and we'll make love, let the telephone ring. Ring, ring, doorbell ring, come on in, I got Mel Blanc on the radio. I'm glad you came around, I've been feeling down, talking to Tony and Mario. You know they make good conversation, still it ain't no consolation, 'cause I got love, maybe I'll give you some, and if somebody comes, let the doorbell ring. Thank you. Ring, ring, voices ring with a happy tune. Anybody can be a singer. The sun comes up across the city. I swear you never looked so young and pretty. Hand in hand, we'll stand upon the sand. Preacher man, let the wind bells ring. Hand in hand, we'll stand upon the sand. Preacher man, let the wind bells ring. A very nice shirt. And I said, yeah, I give up. That light right there is cooking this particular string. I recently drove these guitars through Death Valley in the trunk of a car, and wait till you hear the 12 string. Stood out like a taxidermist elk upon a hill. Friends hung out at the bank, bought a silly house on some very silly land. When anybody asked, I said, this is who I am. Happy, contented, stuffed with dollar bills. I stood out like a taxidermist elk upon a hill. Started out, it used to crack me up. Now it makes me want to cut my throat. So let me play this. Racetrack in Washington, D.C. a long time ago, and there were two Volkswagens racing around the track, wanting, I guess, to demonstrate to all of these idiots out in the field there expecting to hear music that what this was for was cars. So there was this sort of obligato that went through every act that was there, and over time, people got bored, and some of the acts tried to drown out the Volkswagens, and one of the acts succeeded, which was the act that I followed, called Tea Garden and Van Winkle. But speaking of sound guys, the guy was having a problem with the crowd, who, being restless and upset with the Volkswagens, had taken to climbing the stacks so they could stick their head, you know, in the bass bin and get fried, at least something for their money, you know. And the problem was, as soon as a couple of people got on these things, they were on, you know, those old rock and roll sort of scaffoldings that were made of, you know, rubber and spit, and would fall over in a minute and threaten to. And this guy, without saying, look, those are barely up as they are, had to tell these people to stay off. And he kept beseeching them, imploring them, finally telling them, insisting. And for a while it worked. But while Tea Garden and Van Winkle were on, generating more sound level than anyone had for 3 days, this was an act that played a Hammond B3 that had been covered with aluminum or stainless steel. It was tilted. I don't know which. Either Tea Garden or Van Winkle was abusing this thing, and got to the point where he was playing the bass pedals, which are, you know, 40 cycles and below. All they do, all you hear, is heard with everything you have below your waist and above your, well, and down into the ground somewhere. And this proved to be too much for at least one woman to resist. So she jumped up on the stacks and grabbed this 18-inch woofer and was hanging onto it and convulsing. While Tea Garden was pumping away on his thing, and all of a sudden it just gave way, and this whole huge stack of stuff fell with her underneath it all, under this big 18-inch woofer with this huge cabinet. And it was like the Wizard of Oz, where you see the witch's feet sticking from under the thing. So what this sound man had been warning everyone about had happened. But at that point, he had enough, and he turned up the volume. You have to be careful with these guys. We all loved it, of course. Had to. It's pretty hard to follow a crushing like that. This is a song called Regards from Chuck Pink that'll bleed into another tune. And Chuck Pink was a guy, a dead ringer for Chuck Berry, who worked at Pink's Hot Dog Stand in Los Angeles. And he had a temper that was just repellent. This guy would blow up at anything for any reason. He knew that he misled children and that he abused everybody he could. And it was generally just no good, but he made good hot dogs and so on and so forth. And my manager and I would go down there, order a hot dog or something, and then change our order. It was cheap entertainment. It was a little dangerous. Thank you. not neat enough up there. I believe this was written by a New York native. I know that it was written by Paul Siebel. He wrote some wonderful tunes, and as far as I've been able to determine, I know that he's quit performing, and I've been told that he sells squab now somewhere in the state. Doesn't miss it a bit. I heard this song in a club called The Poison Apple after playing there with another, I believe, New Yorker named Turley Richards, who seems to have vanished. One of those really spectral, bone-chilling tenor voices that just, you know, he could sing anything and tear you to ribbons. He'd been blind twice in his life. You should hear that song. It's hilarious, actually. It's hilarious when he tells it. I used to know why strings go sharp, but I was wrong. Anyhow, Charlie and I had played this club in a really bad time. Matter of fact, it closed within a week after we were there, while a guy named Mick E. Clark was playing there. And yeah, it was part of the deal, this was a long time ago, and part of the deal there was that they would put you up, which turned out to be a little hole up above the club, they put you up with each other. So Turley and I were in there day after day, and Turley would tell me things just from my smell that I didn't want to know myself about myself. It was like living under constant surveillance, and he just delighted in telling me who was there, when, and why, and what my very thoughts were. And on the last night of this horrible, horrible week where nobody came, I'm not exaggerating, there was nobody there. There were a couple staff who had to be there, who were sick of us within 2 nights, of course. Charlie would get up and tell this empty house how he went blind twice in his life and crack himself up and me up. I never got tired of that. And the staff would, you know, grumble. There's a real well-known story about Homer and Jethro when they were real hot in the 50s playing some club out east and being told that nobody had was coming tonight, not a single ticket had been sold. They said, well, that's all right, just forget it and we'll go home. The guy said, no, you gotta play. And they got up and they played for one of these totally empty places. And at the end of the night, they walked off and then they came back on and took an encore. So anyhow, Mick Clark showed up and he said, how is this place? And we said, oh, it's great. You love it. And he said, they're putting me up, they said. We took him up to where they were going to put him. And I think he immediately saw what was wrong, which was everything. And he said, have you ever heard this song? And he played this. They said that Louise was not half bad. It was written on the walls and window shades. And though she'd act the little girl, a deceiver, don't believe her, that's her trade. Sometimes a bottle of perfume, flowers, and maybe some lace. Men brought Louise 10-cent trinkets. Their intention and everybody knew at times she cried. Oh, but women like Louise, they get by. Everybody thought it kind of sad when they found a way in a row. They've always put her down below their kind. Still some cry. Well, I'm going to, Susan likes to take a break here in these sets so that she can make some money too. So mob the bar and somebody drive you home. Does anybody here, ever, speaking of that, ever heard of the, I don't know how to pronounce this, Ragera or Ragera, Ragera in Stockholm, in Sweden? Oh boy, what am I getting into that for? Never mind. If you go there, this gets nowhere. There's no point to it. There is not. I don't know why I brought it up. Yeah, it's just like, well. See, I'm trying not to do so much as blah, 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 because I really get into it. I think it most writers were really candid with their audience. They'd admit that everything that follows after an introduction is just what you play, so you can get to play the introduction. I mean, that's enough for me. I've said that many times. Why do I have to do anything else? I mean, I don't when I'm by myself. That's it. I'm sorry. only know it was cold and white. This is one of my, this is a beautiful, I think, beautiful piece, and admittedly, it sounds better on the instrument it was written for, which was piano and orchestra, but it was arranged most cleverly for me by a guy named Jim Sparks after I failed to come up with anything even resembling music with this. Say about this is it's full of holes. It's very, there's almost nothing to it, which is what I guess I like about it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Called Ice Fields, and I had a chance recently to work up a suite of stuff built around that with a composer named Steve Paulus, who's performed by orchestras more or less throughout the world, and he's alive. We found an orchestra who was willing to perform this with us, and Steve was going to conduct. And so we went to Fort Wayne, Indiana, and did this, and it was broadcast on Performance Tonight, which is the only, I believe, it's the only live orchestra broadcast in the States anymore. And they do things like this. They don't restrict themselves to. They don't restrict themselves. I suppose Jesse's in there sniffing around somewhere, but he didn't bother us. And so we got to do this. But what I wanted to mention was that there was on this particular piece, Steve came up with a double in the string section, so that it'd be boing, 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 boing. Of course, it sounded a little different. It'd be great to get a glossary of the noises players make when they're trying to approximate stuff. Degonk is a great one. Whatever degonk is, it's all over the place. And out of this unison that the strings were doing every now and then, there was one sound. We go, instead of going, it'll be, excuse me, you know what I'm trying to say. I'm embarrassing myself. Can't look up now. Oh, no. Anyhow, I decided that I had to find out who this was, because we had two rehearsals, which is really unusual, as I understand, but they knew I needed it. And at the last rehearsal, we got into this, and this guy was flamming and everything back there. And I turned around just to try, you know, to see what was happening. And it was a guy, and it was instantly obvious who was screwing up. This is the most miserable human being I've ever seen. Should no more have had a violin in his hand than a surgical instrument in a patient opened before him. He should have had a wrench and a mouse or something on the table. Compelling tale. This suite may be available one of these days. We're taking it to Australia and touring with it down there, where it's cheaper to record as well, and where this guy won't follow us from Fortnite. People think of what's wrong with a union. He's the guy they point to. Tune here that's not off of the new record. But there is a record available, and the labels have beseeched me all these years to please mention that when I'm playing, because the people who come to these shows are those most likely, according to them, to buy these records. And whether or not they're correct, I've always felt that I was far too cool to schlep my records up there. And I've noticed that a lot of record distributors are far too cool to schlep them as well. But the company I'm with now is owned and controlled by BMG, which owns most of the planet, so it's a little easier to find this stuff now. And I'm beginning to see their point when they mention it. Perhaps I could have an influence on sales. I'd like to influence sales. And if I have to sell something, I suppose I'm fortunate that I get to sell myself as opposed to somebody else. I quit flying 7 months ago because I really just got sick of it. I've obviously been driving around. I haven't taken to a wagon or anything. I went past an overpass outside of Ashtabula, I think, that says, "Dead people are cool." There's someone who set a realistic goal for themselves. He'll get there. Parenthetically, I worked in a morgue when I was 14 years old in Muskogee, Oklahoma. And I can tell you that the dead people are anything but cool. They may be cold, but they ain't cool. Excuse me, I'm mumbling again. It seems that I've forgotten something that I intended to tell you. That may be fortunate. Let me play this. Thank you. what I wanted to tell you was that while we were recording this record, we were working that I was going to tell you about and didn't, which is called Great Big Boy, Who Was Not Me. We worked in a place called Paul and Mike's Sound Studio. It sounds really, really professional. There'd be a lot of Bauhaus furniture in there. Rude secretaries, door after door after door before you reach that little room where there's this grumpy gnome turning knobs that doesn't want to see you. Knows there are people who can play circles around you that he's recorded many, many, many times. But he'll put up with you. Not so at Paul and Mike's Sound Studio. And Paul and Mike's Sound Studio is a place that does not have any of those charms, and therefore a lot of people won't work there. It's peculiar. But there are also some things that are a little more understandable. It stinks at Paul and Mike's Sound Studio. It smells awful in there, and at first you're just overwhelmed, and but you keep telling yourself how cheap it is. And then you begin to distinguish various layers in this panorama of stink. And the first thing you isolate is toluene and solvents and things like that, which are coming from a litho plant, a silkscreen plant, something like that. Who knows? It's a secret. Across the hall from the studio, which is in the basement. And the guy who runs this uses aliens who do not have green cards, and therefore, on that level alone, he's terrified. And on the other level, he's violating every air quality standard in Los Angeles, so he doesn't dare vent this stuff outdoors where it can be smelled by others. So it's vented into the studio where only musicians put up with it. There's a loading dock. This place isn't soundproofed, which means, in part, that the windows leak. And the windows open up at the top of the basement there on a loading dock where trucks frequently gather to spew, and then it all leaks down into the studio. But fortunately, it's so loud with the truck spewing that you have to stop anyhow before you run a real risk of dying immediately. But then there was a third and a final quality to this stench that gave the room its really electric quality. And once you knew what it was, you couldn't smell an entire illegal litho plant. You couldn't smell the trucks. All you could smell was this other smell, which was an amoeba the size of an omelet growing in the building's caretaker, a guy named Ernesto. One guy or one amoeba who could inundate one of the most powerful industrial hells with just a passing breeze, so to speak. So we started, it didn't take long, and we were complaining to the engineer, Paul, who was also one of the owners, about the stink. And he said, well, I can't, what can we do? It's cheap here, We said, well, it is, we can tolerate the litho plant, we can tolerate the trucks, but we can't tolerate Ernesto and his amoeba. Please, And day after day, he'd say, what are you talking about? Ernesto smells fine. We snobs, he'd call us names and accuse us of all kinds of, just thwarted, distorted motives behind this stink patrol of ours. So finally, we kind of gave up. He insisted that Ernesto did not stink. And just to placate us, he agreed to tell the guy, the caretaker, to please sit at the other end of the building when these wimps are recording here. So he would, and then all he did was sit. He wasn't a devoted caretaker. And one night we went out, boy, excuse me, this is really, I should have written this down and mailed it in somehow. I'm sorry, but I'm stuck. We left to eat, which was a glorious occasion, as you might imagine. And when we came back, full of food, you know, bang, we're hit with the plant, and bang, we're hit with the trucks, and bang, we're hit with Ernesto, who is sitting over here in this plastic chair at the end of the hall from the other end of the studio. And as we walk by, he raises a piece of cheese in his hand. The piece is like a clot. It's a big lump of cheese that had been gnawed on like this. That was, you know, you'd have been hard-pressed to convince anyone that that was just Ernesto's mouth. You saw the marks up on it. These are very big bites. And as we passed by, Ernesto lifted this thing and he said, "Want some cheese?" But this is our moment. We saw it, it shined like a light. And we stopped and we looked at Paul, who had insisted for weeks that there was nothing wrong with Ernesto. And so Paul, being the smart man that he is, ate some cheese. But what I have to tell you, I mean, if you've ever exacted vengeance, you know that at the moment you achieve this thing that you lusted after, you're overwhelmed with regret. And then, you know, and as he built bit into this cheese, and we were horrified at what we had done. Every day in the morning when you get up and you crawl out. Santa Fe to somewhere. Nearly drove off the road. Because that's... You don't get tired of that. I don't care if you... So, and I enjoyed every bit of it. And when it was done, when I was done listening to me play, the disc jockey came on and he said, "A lot of people don't like that song." Yeah, sure. I mean, really. Why did you play it? And then he said, "But it is the most requested song off of Ryoka." And then he gave this huge Mustangs plug. And I was thrilled. So if you don't like it, suffer, and if you do, I'm greatly relieved. This is a couple of very old pieces for me. I haven't gotten tired of them. I thought everybody else did, so I quit playing them for a while. Quit playing them for a while. Fortunately, they don't require any singing. Speech seems to be leaving me now. So I started playing them again. You never who you were again. Some tunes you'll never write again. This is a couple. I'd like to thank you for coming out tonight, and I'd like to mention with every bit of affection I could muster, which isn't hard, my friend Stanley Watson, who used to live here. Started his guitar lessons with the Bronze Age. Literally, so you knew where these frets came from in all of the lives and generations. It was wonderful. He'd sit under a pear tree and turn people on. Thank you. I used to play with picks, and Stanley came to a show. I think the last show I did here, the last time I saw Stanley, he said, "You know, you keep playing with those, you're gonna ruin your arm." And in about 6 months, my arm was ruined. You can hear Stanley on a couple of records, but as great a player as he was, he suffered from a really horrible and ironic affliction, which was stage fright. It just beset him like flies when he tried to perform. You had to hear him at home.